This edition of Section D was first broadcast on Monocle 24 on the 10th of April 2012. Section D in association with Lexis. Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24. I'm Hugo MacDonald. We've got a new generation theme in this week's episode, celebrating people and places in design, fashion, architecture and retail that are pushing the industry forward. Coming up over the next hour, we head to Cape Town to hear how the South African capital is shaping up after recently being crowned the World Design Capital for 2014.
In looking and surveying the landscape and thinking, well, what would be the levers towards enhancing our competitiveness as a nation? Clearly, creativity had to be there.
We drop in on the new director of Vienna's Museum of Applied Arts, Christoph Thun Hohenstein.
Because everybody needs the occasional blockbuster, but what's really interesting to me is to produce exhibitions people keep raving about afterwards.
And we hear how a young denim brand in New York is shaking up the retail scene with its vertically integrated business model.
People seem to be genuinely interested in that process. I mean, it's fascinating, A, because you don't know what it is, but more often than not, most people really thought that you actually just walk up to a big denim machine, you press a button, and out comes a jean.
All that in the next hour, plus we hear a bit of this. And some of this. That would be the music played by Bridges. Yes, Bridges. More on that shortly. You're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. Australian-born, Berlin-based artist Jodie Rose has spent the last decade travelling the globe recording the sounds that Bridges make. Her goal, which she's recently realised, is to turn these different tracks into a singing bridge symphony. Jodie visited Midori House last week and brought her music into Studio 2, where she took me through the story of her unlikely pastime.
When I was at art school in Sydney, I was going across the old Pyrmont Bridge and they were building the new Anzac Bridge next to this, and it was gigantic. It's like 40 metres high or something, and it looks like a big harp. And so I was curious about what the cables would sound like, and we had a public art project at the time, which was imagine if anything was possible. No constraints at all. What would you do? And I came up with this idea, like, I'd like to hear this bridge, but I'd actually also like to create a global bridge symphony. And so the idea of the bridges all kind of singing together, like I imagine the sound of the cables as being like the voice of the bridge.
This is amazing. Well, let's get straight into hearing what the bridges sound like. And maybe we should start with the Anzac Bridge, if that was where the inspiration first came from.
That was my very first recording. I wrote to the engineer. They thought I sounded a little bit nuts, but they gave me permission to record it while it was still a building site. And ABC Radio actually came up with their engineers and helped me make the recording.
Well, let's listen to it. I mean, that's incredible because it sounds so electronic, but also after what you've just said, with the idea of playing a giant harp, you can kind of hear that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the bridges actually sound really musical. And I'm using music, I guess, in an extended sense, like John Cage, that the act of paying attention to something is what creates music from what may otherwise be seen as noise. But I think in the last 10 years, there's been a huge development of, you know, sonic art and these kind of experimental sounds. So it's a kind of palette or texture that people are maybe a little bit more used to hearing. But what's really exciting for me is that those sounds are purely the sound of the bridge. Like I usually don't do any electronic manipulation. I have to confess there's a little bit of delay on that one. That's the only
we'll forgive you that.
it was my first time.
No. I mean, it's amazing. And how on earth do you go about doing it?
It's actually very simple. I use contact microphones, which are a Shaler Oyster piezo transducer, which sounds complex, but it's actually a very small disc that picks up the vibration. It's a little bit like a guitar pickup. And so I just choose a bridge, go up to the bridge, and I put the contact microphones on different parts of the structure, usually on the cables, but I've actually found there's a very thick polyethylene plastic casing that's put onto most of the cables. So this Anzac Bridge was really special because it was under construction and we could actually put the microphones inside the multi-strands. There's like 75 cables inside one of those big ones. And so the sounds are from like all these different cables kind of popping together. I mean, I think the laser sounds in Star Wars were recorded with high tensile wires, a little bit similar to that. So some of the kind of pew, pew noises are also maybe familiar from other contexts, but this is, you know, really purely just the bridge.
Amazing. And, I mean, you've discovered over the last 10 years that bridges have different sounds.
Every bridge has its own voice, yes.
I love that. Should we move on to another bridge?
Well, we can go to the bridge song in G, which is the first one. And this was actually really special because I'd been doing the project for about 5 years and an engineer building a bridge actually somehow found my website and wrote to me and said, "Hi, I'm building a bridge. Would you like to come and make art with it?" Sure. And so it was called the Green Bridge in Brisbane. It's now the Eleanor Chanel Bridge. And I actually got to build the, we used accelerometers then, so it's like a very high, high-end scientific measuring device for vibration. They have them inside phones. And I've got a new app in development which uses the accelerometer in smartphones that I want people to be able to go up to any bridge and place their phone on the bridge and send me the sound. So anyway, I actually got to build the accelerometers into the cables of this bridge so that you can listen to it while you're going across. And the sound in this composition is sounds from the construction, from the cables being installed.
So you can see me beaming across the table from you.
That's great.
The response that you get when you listen to a new or different bridge, can you pinpoint everything that's happening in the sounds?
It's always really exciting for me when I go and like walk onto a bridge and hear it for the first time, because it's like something, it really transforms the world that you're in and the sort of state of and your perception, because it's such a like delicate, intimate sound. And so I can often imagine what kind of range of sounds I think might be there in the structure, but I'm actually always surprised as well.
Looking further down the list of bridges that we have here, there's the Golden Gate Bridge, which is...
That's one of my favourites.
Okay, good. It was one of my favourites in one of my favourite cities as well. We've just come back from a trip to San Francisco.
Oh, wonderful.
It must have been a bit like a pilgrimage, presumably.
This was actually, I recorded the Golden Gate. It was the last bridge I recorded on my international bridge tour in 2002, which I started on, in fact, the 5th of April at the My Thuan Bridge in Vietnam.
Mildly terrifying.
I really love that. It's such a wild, intense sound.
Isn't it? I think you get such a sense of sort of the industrial scale of it.
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge bridge and you can really hear the tension in the structure, and that's just the sound that was there happening. It's also twisted steel cables with nothing around them. So it's really like just tuning into a gigantic kind of guitar string. So that is actually one of my favourites.
It's absolutely amazing. I mean, from the huge to maybe the slightly more delicate, you mentioned going down to the Millennium Bridge later.
Yes.
And it's a pedestrian bridge. It doesn't have anything like the number of sort of footfall or traffic of something like the Golden Gate Bridge. Should we hear if that sounds very different then?
What I really like about this one is that you hear this kind of chattering in the cables, and it's a very different kind of tonality. And then, of course, the people walking across. So there's a sort of mixture. It's often the rhythm is from the cars going over the expansion joints.
And this one, it's smooth, whereas this is much more kind of clunky, clunky.
It's more sort of syncopated and like a little
high
bit more
heels on their way to work in the city.
Exactly.
Tell me a little bit about, I mean, you mentioned that you went on a world tour of bridges in, was it 2002?
And 2002.
When you come back with all of the material, you to put it together, or you're going to put it together into the Bridge Global Bridge Symphony?
I did release a CD in 2005, which was Vibrations, or it's Singing Bridges, Vibrations, Variations. And so I had 15 tracks of the bridges I'd recorded. And I actually tried to keep it very simple, like not to get in the way of the sound, but really just that I'm acting like a channel for the voices of these bridges, which are amazing in themselves. But then I also offered the material to a lot of sound artists and musicians who made really interesting, beautiful remixes. And so it kind of varies from very ambient to quite industrial kind of electronica sounds. And they were just using the bridges. I think Francisco Lopez did one, Jakob Kierkegaard, just people I'd met in my travels. I've done some experiments with trying to make a composition, taking the different sounds and using them in a kind of music concrete way. So as sonic kind of textures rather than as this is one bridge, this is another, so that they become like instruments in this composition. And so the Global Symphony sort of sketch that I have is from, I did some work with Michael Bates at the University of Sydney, and we were actually kind of sampling them and then playing with the sounds and bringing out the resonance.
Amazing. Actually, now it sounds like a soundtrack to a very futuristic film, doesn't it?
I had someone say once they thought a lot of them sounded like they could be soundtracks to possibly horror films or sci-fi, I think.
Do you look at the physical structure? And also, do you sort of look at, I mean, obviously the Golden Gate Bridge, very famous, everybody sort of knows what it looks like, but when it comes to new bridges being built, do you think, oh, well, it's interesting that they're doing that in a certain sort of way, and I wonder what sound that will create that is different from a bridge that you've done in the past, say?
I've worked with musicians before. Sometimes I make a visual score, and so it's based on the structure of the bridge, like on the architecture, and I use that as the kind of score. And then the first visual scores I did were the Golden Gate and the Millennium Bridge, which are very different. But because the Millennium Bridge here, it suffered from synchronous lateral excitation, it's a technical term, which meant that when all the people walked across it on the opening day and their footsteps fell into rhythm, it swayed really noticeably.
I can remember that in the press. There was huge uproar here.
Yeah, so they had to actually damp the cables. And so I had some of the technical drawings from that I just got from online. And then the Golden Gate Bridge, I was kind of using like electronics diagrams and wind. There's a really nice kind of symbol for wind. And so it was a mixture of different kinds of symbols and then my own ideas about how it could be played as a score. But so, I mean, the new bridges, I guess I'm kind of quite fixed on cable stayed and suspension bridges. And there's some variation in how they're made, but there's a fairly sort of, there's a usual kind of template that they follow as well.
You obviously know a huge amount, though, about the sort of way bridges are built.
I've picked up quite a bit. And actually, one of the other engineers who wrote to me, Pelle Gustafsson, a Swedish engineer who works with VSL International, he was building the mega bridge in Bangkok. And he wrote to me and said, I'm building a bridge. I want to hear it played like Jimi Hendrix. How can you say no to that? It's actually interesting, that bridge was picking up the radio, and so the Thai pop song you can hear coming through was coming, I was picking that up through the bridge when I was amplifying it, yes.
Oh my goodness, and that was presumably very unexpected.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's happened once or twice. There was a bridge next to the Eiffel Tower in Paris also did that, and the one in Brisbane. But because I have this sort of, you know, philosophical, poetic fantasy about bridges sending signals to each other, like Michel Serre, the French philosopher, writes about the world speaking in this very sophisticated language that we can't begin to understand. And so for me, there's something like this untranslatable bridge language going on, and the fact that they also receive signals and send them is really lovely. So that's why I do include some of the radio that I pick up sometimes.
Jodie, what's next for you?
I'm still really fascinated by the sounds of bridges, but I'm also really interested in the way that different people respond to the idea and to the work. And so I get to make really lovely collaborations. At the moment, I'm working with a sculptor called Andy Holton from Washington, D.C. We started working on these, the sculpture, which is like an object based on the silhouette of a bridge. which actually plays the sound. And so I still want to make this as a little like dinky souvenir, like the FM3 Buddha machine that plays the chants. But what we're working on now is actually a larger scale, like about 1.52 meters silhouette of a bridge made in chroma, which is this really beautiful resin material. And it just transmits light really beautifully. So this is actually going to be a bridge light. It'll be for the Australian Embassy in Berlin. I'm having a show there later in the year. And so we'll be having the bridge lights made for that.
Wonderful. Well, I think maybe to wrap up, should we go to the high coast?
Oh, this one's wild. This is one in Sweden, which is very like the Golden Gate Bridge. And the engineer actually took us up into the room where the expansion joints are. And there's all this really crazy stuff.
That was me with artist and bridge fanatic Jodie Rose in Studio 2 of Midori House. You're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. Time for a short break, but stay tuned. We're off to Cape Town after this.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus. Creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
The Briefing is Monocle 24's fast-paced current affairs hour at midday London time. We review the American front pages fresh off the press, check in on the stories unfolding in Europe, and round up the events at the end of the day in Asia.
Who is the true conservative? This is the question voters and primaries are going to have to be asking themselves.
Wake up in New York to The Briefing, live every weekday at midday London time.
Beating Dublin and Bilbao, Cape Town secured the World Design Capital bid for 2014. While South African design is still struggling to emerge from the days of political isolation, which plagued all aspects of society, Cape Town is taking the initiative to rebrand the city as a World Design Centre. The city's mission is that South African designers will find a new pride in their ability to address social problems through design innovation. Monocle's reporter Joseph Dana spoke to the key proponents to find out more.
Visiting Cape Town for the first time, one is immediately struck by two things: the staggering natural beauty of the city and the desperate social problems which plague it. South Africa has undergone a profound change in the past 20 years, but dire social issues still tax the country. From water to housing to extreme poverty, the problems facing South Africa provide designers ample opportunity to use innovation for the betterment of society.
So we come at design from a very, very strategic place. I'm not a designer, but in looking and surveying the landscape and thinking, well, what would be the levers towards enhancing our competitiveness as a nation? Clearly, creativity had to be there.
Ravi Naidu is the founder of Design Indaba, a design institution based in Cape Town, which began just after the country's transition to democracy in 1995.
Clearly, innovation has to be there, and design. And I wasn't seeing this in the national discourse. I wasn't seeing this on the national agenda, and we made it our mission to be able to put that onto the national agenda.
Cape Town has recently been selected as the World Design Capital for 2014 by the International Council for Societies of Industrial Design. The distinction gives prominence to cities that use design for their social, economic, and cultural development, and previous capitals include Torino, Seoul, and Helsinki. Sitting outside the popular Vita Cafe, architect Tsai explained his latest design project, which directly addresses one of the major problems facing Cape Town's urban core and townships. He is the director of the Tsai Design Studio, which employs his Eastern design thinking with inspiration from South Africa's diverse culture.
Shack fires in Cape Town is a huge problem. It occurs on a weekly basis, and it literally ravages thousands of shacks at one go, kills lives. So we started, a few of us designers started talking and thinking, how can we actually deal with this problem in a creative way? And one of the designer was an ex-DIY editor for a magazine, and he says, I came across this fire retardant paint made in South Africa. Why don't we look into that? So it became a project using paint to prevent the spread of shack fires. And the second thing, objective, is that since we are already doing paint, why don't we then sort of use color as a community upliftment and get them involved and paint a variety of color on shacks. And the third thing is, now why are we turning this negative situation into a positive situation? Why don't we think bigger? If we're going to paint thousands of shacks, what about the rooftop? Why can't, as you fly into Cape Town, instead of seeing this informal settlement, you can see an amazing picture of a land art?
There is an undeniable excitement in Cape Town concerning design these days, but questions about the quality of South African design still linger. The annual Design Indaba Expo just concluded in March, with a strong showing of South African designers like Sai that are continuing to think about design as a vehicle for social change. Ravi Naidu believes that this is why the World Design Capital is a perfect fit for Cape Town.
The World Design Capital is a great branding exercise in some respects. In some respects, it's a wonderful, smart idea of ICSID, the International Council for and Society for Industrial Designers, to offer this trophy. And what I really like is this kind of design consciousness that is emerging in the city, where politicians, civil society, businesses, schools are all engaged in this conversation about design. And I think, you know, it's always been part of our agenda, even at Design Indaba, is that we are less excited about design for consumption and more excited about design as a lever and as an instrument and as part of a toolkit to improve the quality of life. I think design needs to serve a higher purpose. And design, when it's you utilize design thinking and utilize creativity to be able to ameliorate conditions, makes things better, whether it's in the townships, etc., it is when design for us resonates and is relevant. So we subscribe to the definition of design as being that skill or facility to improve the quality of life.
South Africa's turbulent history has taken a clear toll on its design community.
This is Karen's garden. This is just incredible. It's always busy.
There's a certain lack of pride among South African designers, according to Porky Heffer, a fixture of Cape Town design circles, known for his forward-thinking approaches to interior design and bold outdoor art installations. He explained the lack of pride from his studio, a historic 17th-century manor in the shadow of the iconic Table Mountain.
The problem with South African design that I'm experiencing, and I can only speak for myself, is that we're so far away from market, which is a huge cost. Already we have no manufacture, so our costs are high already, and then for us to get it to an overseas market, it's just prohibitive. Other thing is our local market is not very switched on. I think due to, you know, a history of isolation during the apartheid years, we were always sort of taught that anything from overseas is better. And that was stuck. I mean, you know, we've got lots of legacies of bad from apartheid, but that definitely was one, because immediately during that period, you know, the only brands we wanted was Levi's. And it was just so strange that there was no internal reflection, but there wasn't a South African pride.
For a country blessed with natural resources, South Africa still has a long way to go in nurturing its own design industry. The hope among many in Cape Town is that the World Design Capital Honor will help South African designers live up to the mantra, design for the other 90%, and maybe, just maybe, rekindle a national pride in South African design. For Monocle, in Cape Town, I'm Joseph Dana.
Time for a song, and this isn't sung by a bridge. This is by Little Dragon, and it's called Blinking Pigs. Blinking Pigs by Little Dragon. Staying with the theme of new beginnings, we dispatched David Pleasant off to the Architecture Foundation, south of the river in London, to hear from three young Danish architects who've recently embarked on an exchange programme with three British counterparts. David dropped in on an inaugural lecture the six of them gave to find out more.
Architectural styles and tendencies often jettison around the world. 20th century architecture was after all dominated by what is often called the international style. But how international is architecture for young practitioners? Education and opportunities in architecture are drastically different depending on which country you happen to find yourself in. In the latest of its international exchanges, the UK's Architecture Foundation has teamed up with the Danish Architecture Centre to try and close the gap between the knowledge and experience of these two countries at least. I went to a night of presentation, wine and pizza at the Architecture Foundation's South London HQ.
My name is Klaus and I am the owner of the architectural firm with the same name, Klaus Puls Architect. Danish architecture were topping in the early 1960s, but now again it's like with the Bjarke Ingels studio, we are topping again around the whole globe. I would say that we are very different kind of perspective on architecture, and mainly Mass and I are like having this very local and hands-on way of looking on architecture. But you can say all over we are building in a very kind of great detailing in all the projects, and that is something that, you know, if you here in Britain there, you can talk about a lack of detail, but I actually mean that in a positive way, because
it has its pros and cons. You can get stuck on the detail, you mean. Maybe it's a problem sometimes.
Yeah. It sometimes happens to get a bit too fine. I mean, it's too nice to look at. So you don't want to, you know, be in the building. And if you here in Britain, it's much more put together. And that kind of like make a more relaxing area or a relaxing space. And
it's more freedom. You feel it's a more liberal environment.
Yeah. You can relax in the space.
Okay. I think a lot of people in London might disagree with you. Yeah, but that's a very interesting perspective.
Yeah. Well, my name is Mads Bjørn Hansen. I'm a partner together with my wife in a practice called Praxis Architecture.
Do you have any common reference point as a Danish architect with the others, or do you see yourself as very separate?
I think in many ways we're talking about the same things, but I would say in particularly Klaus Puls here today and for that instance Duggan Morris and these new kind of Britishness is very much in the same way that we're thinking. And over here you got Sergeant and Bates and other companies that are doing more or less the same thing that we're trying. So,
so do you see yourself, I mean, as an architect, based on the site that you're given at the time, you don't kind of look at a Danish paradigm. It's not conscious in your design philosophy. I mean, it's not something that you're overly aware of.
Well, we have read our history, of course, and today you see architecture is all international style in a way, more or less. But if we should draw something up in Danish architecture, for instance, it must be the 30s, 40s, 50s, Kai Fisker, Arne Jacobsen, these old guys who were working in a Danish international way. Today it's just international. Mm-hmm. And I guess if you should say something, it's in that direction that we are going to, just some years later.
My name is Sarah Ichioka, and I'm director of the Architecture Foundation. We're a nonprofit based here in London, but with an international remit. Well, we're always really interested in what our European neighbors are doing. I think very often in a grass being greener on the other side of the fence situation, British architects often look really enviously to our Nordic cousins in terms of competition system.
We do hear these kind of Scandinavian comparisons a lot, not just in architecture, but in politics, in just about everything. But speaking to some of the Danish architects, they really seem to have got something back as well. They're taking a bit of kind of the design or architecture philosophy that we have here in London, if there is such a thing, back to Copenhagen or Denmark. Do you think, has the exchange succeeded, do you think?
I hope so. I think we often judge the exchange several months or years down the line after it's happened. We tend to check in with participants to see what influences they've carried forward. Often there are collaborations that arise from the programs. But yes, from the initial conversations that have happened in Copenhagen and here in London, it seems like it is a really fruitful two-way dialogue, absolutely, looking at different models of commissioning, different standards of social engagement, for example, different definitions of inclusion, diversity, etc. I hope it has been equally productive for both sides.
My name's Joe Morris, Doug and Morris Architects. We've had 3 or 4 days in Copenhagen, and then the reciprocal amount in the UK, of which we're on the third day, so effectively 2 days. So we've known each other for 5 working days. 2 of those days were involved in a workshop, which was a heated debate focused specifically on the title of the programme, which is the citizen integration. What I found is that the UK practices were incredibly open and engaged and confident in discussing the issues involved around something which was quite specific to the Copenhagen condition. It's interesting, actually, having seen the presentations this evening, again, talking about the two practices. So there's Praxis and there's Klaus, two wonderful individuals, both of them producing the most elegant, poetic, textual, contextual work that any UK-based practice would almost cut their arm off to be involved with. And we'll take a lot from that.
The mutual admiration between the British and Danish architects I met was clear. What was even clearer was the importance of the interaction that was occurring between the practitioners involved. This kind of international fusion is something the architecture profession excels in, if it is given the chance at least. For Monocle, in London, this is David Pleasant.
You're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. We're off to Vienna after this.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
LDNTYO. NYC MT4.
Welcome back to Section D. There's a wind of youthful change blowing through some of Vienna's larger cultural institutions. Christoph Thun Hohenstein took over as director of the Museum of Applied Arts, otherwise known as the MAC, towards the end of last year. The dynamic young man has big ambitions in his new post. Our Vienna correspondent Kimberly Bradley visited him in his museum office to hear about his first exhibition and his wider plans for the MAC.
Well, Envision and Buildings, as it's called in English, is a show that's really the interface between contemporary art, in that case art photography and also film, and on the other hand architecture. And it's really about how contemporary artists working in those mediums perceive architecture. There's a lot of modern architecture in it, on those photos and in those films. But basically, it really represents one of the key elements of the future mission of the MAC, that is to evaluate progress in one given field, also by means of looking into it in other fields. So one discipline kind of deals with another discipline, which brings about different conclusions in the different set of evaluation than the normal intra-disciplinary approach, you know. So artists have a lot to say about architecture, especially modern architecture, and their conclusions are quite different from what happens in the architectural field itself. The next show will be a show that Hartmut Esslinger, together with our design curator Thomas Geisler, will be curating. And Hartmut Esslinger was founder of Rock Design in California and a long-time close collaborator of Steve Jobs, and also designer of the Snow White Apple line, as you can remember. And Hartmut is one of today's, I would say, major strategic design thinkers and designers, and he has developed a show together with our design curator that's called Made for You, design for change or design for positive change. And it's really about this new role of design and how design-oriented companies worldwide are very successful taking designers on board and working and kind of delivering the right product for you. And later on, this is kind of preparing the ground for new positioning of the MAC. And we are working towards having a European triennial for change in 2014, which then would take place every 3 years in Vienna. And it's about major contributions of designers, architects, smart fashion designers, and contemporary artists with regard to the kind of innovations I mentioned earlier. So positive change in many respects. You know, we are very spoiled. We have a fantastic museum scene. It's really, if you compare it with normal sizes of cities, you have an art life here for a city much bigger than Vienna actually is, which is very good. But what we have to bear in mind is the goal should really be to interest much broader parts of society for museums and for what they can look at and learn in museums, yeah, rather than trying, and this is unfortunately to a certain extent the case, to grab the audience from the other museum by very commercial programming in the museums. Yeah, I mean, to a certain extent, of course, everybody needs the occasional blockbuster. But what's really interesting to me is to produce exhibitions people keep raving about afterwards. Yeah. So in 5 years, if you look back, what were the outstanding exhibitions in Vienna? This is really the score then you have to make, because each and every exhibition have to bring the topic to a new level. I'm very confident that in Vienna, this also new approach of we don't have to compete in terms of grabbing the audience of the others, but we have to compete in doing excellent exhibitions, yeah? And but also kind of sticking to what our core mandate is. So when we work with contemporary art, we'll certainly always deal with it from also an applied arts point of view. Otherwise, it wouldn't make sense.
That was Kimberly Bradley with Christoph Thun Hohenstein at the MAC in Vienna. Over in New York, our editor Aisha Spears dropped in on an intriguing new denim brand called 3x1. The Soho store and atelier has a denim gallery, where customers choose their preferred material and have jeans made up for them, all under one roof. Aisha visited them to find out how this simple production and retail formula has proved to be a very sound business model.
Thank you. 3x1 it's kind of a concept shop more than anything else. We have a retail store, a design studio, atelier with a little factory upstairs. We make jeans.
For the customers, like, can we talk a little bit about the customer experience? Because obviously to describe it on radio for listeners, so you come into a huge space and you can see everything being made. What do you find interesting about working so directly with the customer?
Well, I mean, the greatest reward truly is the fact that, just like I always imagined it would be, is, you know, when I used to talk to my friends about this is what I do for a living, I fly to this place and I work in this factory, or we develop something in Kentucky all week long and we sit in a factory and design stuff. People seem to be genuinely interested in that process. I mean, it's fascinating, A, because you don't know what it is, but more often than not, most people really thought that you actually just walk up to a big denim machine and you press a button and out comes a jean. And, you know, they don't really understand how much handwork, how much real processing time, you know, how many people it takes to actually make that one product that you wear. And I think the unique thing about that first step of walking into the space and seeing all the components broke down, whether it's the denim wall with, you know, 75 or 80 different denims, seeing all the pattern pieces laid out in that first huge display case, you know, all those different pieces are pieces that take to make every pair of jeans. And then being able to go back into the sewing areas and see all that stuff happening and be like, my gosh, there's 32 machines here. You know, do you really need that many machines to make something? You don't really need 32 machines, but, you know, there's basically about 14 different machines that you need to make the one jean that we want to make. And, you know, it's really unique, I think, for any customer to be able to have A, just that level of transparency, and then B, to go one step further and really try and say, you know, no matter what pair of jeans you buy here, you still have that choice finally in the rivets and the buttons, and we hem everything. We make it, you know, basically all those adjustments here while you wait. Even that is a pretty substantial shift in the way people do retail. And I think that's something that really resonates well and strongly with our customers.
Everything here, this is where everything gets made from start to finish?
Mm-hmm. Well, across the way, that's where they do the buttons and the rivets.
Okay.
And over there, they do pressing.
Can we talk specifically about the styles that are available? Because in terms of the different tiers of jean that someone can buy, and then also the styles that they can work from.
Sure. We've got, I mean, the basic premise is you can come in off the street. We have almost 1,100 pair of jeans in stock. So between men, women, and we actually do a couple kids' jeans as well. You can come in, you can find something, you can try something on right away. These are all designs that I've designed or things that I think are really, you know, some of our best stuff, quite frankly. And these are a lot of, these are in our favorite fabrics. These are things that a custom-made type customer or a custom-made level would be able to pull off the wall, so to speak. So these are fantastic jeans. They're made the exact same way. There's no difference. The difference is you get to try those on, and if you find one that you like, that's great. You purchase your jean, we hem it to your whatever specifications, and then basically you pick out the buttons and you pick out the rivets and you're out the door.
And that can all be done in one shot?
That literally can be done as fast as you can find a pair that you like.
Okay.
So in some cases that can be 20, 30 minutes. I mean, our staff is fantastic, really, at trying to evaluate kind of what you like and putting you into the right thing quickly. So that's kind of the limited edition level. One of the things that's unique about each of those jeans is we basically make a finite number. So if that's typically 8, 12, 16, or 24 pieces of that one style, we make it in that one fit with the one thread theory or back pocket combination. That's once it's done, it's done. So you're going to get an individually numbered jean. You know that we're not making lots of those, so that's kind of a neat thing for a lot of customers. But that's just our regular ready-to-wear or limited edition product. The next level up would be something called custom-made. And custom made is really, I think, where everyone starts to have a lot of fun, because what they do is they can go pick any of the different items we have in the store. You could have a custom made bag, you can have a custom made anything. But basically, you find the fit in the jean that you would like, if let's say it's a jean. You would then go into the fabric selection process, and you get about 135 different denims to choose from. So you go through all the fabric selection process, and you can learn as much as you want about the different qualities of denim, the weights, the mills, where they come from. You select your denim, then you select your thread colors, your back pocket design. You know, the numbers, obviously there's an infinite number of combinations. Yeah. There's a huge amount of different steps, but the buttons, the rivets, whether you want a zipper fly or a button fly, belt loops, what type of belt loop, what type of stitching, et cetera, et cetera. So that's a custom-made product. And then from there, we have the next step up, which is bespoke. And bespoke, we limit to 100 appointments a year. We basically have a customer come in, and the customer can come in, and they can literally bring in anything from a cocktail napkin to a favorite pair of jeans or a pant or any inspiration. It can be anything you want. And we really sit down, and we try and build your product from ground up. And we digitize that finished product. We create a digital marker, a digital pattern. We keep that in stock here. You can call up anytime from anywhere in the world. We can remake that pair in a different denim or do anything else you want to it and send it out to you wherever you are. Okay. It's a different mentality probably of customer. I mean, most customers, myself included, don't really have a special fit or a special concept or something that, you know, I couldn't find in our regular limited edition versions or in the custom aids. But, you know, for certain people, you know, whether they're a little bit taller or whether they have just a really unique idea that they want to try and bring forward, it's a great opportunity for them. And I think it's really neat to be able to have different perspectives on what their favorite best pair of jeans could be, whether it's a bell bottom or a boot cut or high rise or low rise. It really doesn't matter. So I think it really more than anything, it's about trying to get someone who may not have an easy time kind of articulating what their design idea is, trying to pull that out of them and really make sure that they get something that they love. And if they do, it's, you know, it's a pretty neat feeling.
Each sewer sticks with the one pair from beginning to end. So there are a few machines that do different things, but the same sewer stays with that. So what do you think the kind of future of the denim industry or the jean is over the next few years?
I mean, I think the future of retail, and I think the future of clothing is going to go, it's going to obviously continue to be a little bit more fragmented. I think for people who place a high priority on what they're wearing or have exacting standards about what they're wearing, I think there's going to be a lot more options to have your own personal influence. I know Burberry's already started doing it. I think a lot of brands are looking at bespoke or some levels of customization or personalization may be the right way. And I think, you know, there's a lot more creativity, it seems like, coming into the market. There's lots of people who have opinions, lots of people who are great curators. I mean, I think it's part of the digital age that we're in right now. But I think those choices will need to somehow get flushed through into the final product for those people to be really happy. So I think that's one tract. But I also think there's another tract, and I think that will always be there. People who just say, I don't really care, it's a pair of jeans, you know, just give me something that looks okay and I'll be happy. So I think you'll continue to see big brands, you know, do good stuff for a decent price. And I think you'll probably, you know, you'll see a little bit more of an evolution of things, maybe not exactly the way we're doing it, but where people are invited into the process and be able to have their own stamp put on things.
And what's the, do you know what this is? This is just a cut.
So he's doing, what he does is chalks and cuts each piece. And then he puts it into a little bundle and then gives it to the sewer.
Okay.
And then she creates the whole jean.
I see.
Yeah. That was our New York editor, Aisha Spears, at 3x1 in Soho, New York. And that brings us to the end of this week's Section D. We'll be back next week with an architecture special. We'll be bringing you a rundown from the Chicago Architecture and Design Film Festival, a studio visit to Paulista architect Marcio Kogan, and a brief survey of the contemporary architecture scene in Norway. So be sure to tune in then. This week's show was produced by Gillian Tobias. It was edited by Holly Fisher. I'm Hugo MacDonald. And playing us out, in honour of the Salone del Mobile, which begins next Monday in Milan, here's Beirut with Postcards from Italy. Thank you very much for listening. Bye-bye.